With our very special guest tonight, Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll talk more with Richard about all things out there in science, and we'll take some phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got Richard C. Hoagland. We've got your phone calls as well. Richard, the spiral in the past, I believe you said it was some kind of a device that was used to capture the Russian rocket?
It appears to have been some kind of torsion physics, torsion technology, which involves vortices in the ether, spiral waves. And it literally, I mean, if you're familiar with any of the science fiction concepts of tractor beams, you know, where on the Enterprise, you know, the captain says, lock on, Scotty, the tractor beam.
Yep.
That's apparently what this did. It took the Russian missile and it basically mangled it. It spiraled it out of control, stopped it almost dead in the air from moving at 12,000 miles an hour. That requires enormous, humongous energy, George. And it created this incredible vortex of light, which appeared to be the spiraling fuel as this thing was shaken. Think of like a rat shaken by a dog, except the dog's invisible. And then you had this corkscrew blue beam, which was seen emanating from the center, aimed down toward the ground, almost as if it had been projected. I mean, you could look at it two ways, that it was projected from orbit, from space, down toward the ground, or it was a technology which was based either in northern Norway or even in the old Soviet Union. The lines of sight and the angles line up to an ancient facility, ancient from the 1970s, that was being used by the Russians to test some of this kind of physics in this old Soviet Union. One of those two locations, you can plot this cork spiral, this blue, incredible blue beam spiral, which made everybody, of course, think instantly of so-called Project Blue Beam. Except when this appeared. And you know, George, as well as I, when this remarkable thing appeared over northern Norway, which was one day before the President of the United States is supposed to arrive and accept his Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yep.
The same night, flash forward the film now, a few hours later, we've got two Russian amateurs running around in some kind of car through downtown Moscow, going back and forth across certain bridges that are next to the Kremlin. And floating above the old cathedrals, the old Russian Orthodox onion skin domes, and the brilliantly illuminated red square in the middle of the night is this tetrahedron about the size of a football field hovering in midair on this television video, which was put out of the former Soviet Union of Russia, and which was all over Russian television, the equivalent of Russian YouTube. Now, the only way you get things on Russian YouTube without having them yanked down quickly is if the Russian government wants you to see something.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
Which means the Russians wanted the West to see whatever this thing was. And there's been all kinds of controversy over, was it fake? Was it faked in the computer? Was it a video fake? Well, for one thing, how does one get that incredible amount of detail in a video in only a few hours from the morning when the Norway spiral appeared and was basically effective in yanking down a Soviet ballistic missile launch? The synchronization of these two events together the same day, one over northern Norway and one over Moscow, few hours before Obama himself is to arrive in Oslo in southern Norway to accept the Nobel Peace Prize, seems to me, and seemed to me then and seems to me now, to be consistent with someone showing up and demonstrating a very major technological and scientific capability which puts all our public science and technology, particularly rockets, in the shade. I mean, there's no way that you can stand up to that kind of an adversary who has that kind of physics and technology behind them. So it appeared to be a huge show of force without killing anybody, like a message.
But the message could have also come from? ETs?
Well, it could have come from any one of a number of factions on this planet. It could have come from an extraterrestrial source off planet. It could have come from humans who have been, shall we say, pursuing a separate history post-World War II, and I'm talking now about Dr. Farrell and his assessment of the Nazi Internationale, or it could have been from someone who is a genuine extraterrestrial, even a genuine alien who shows up, takes stock of the situation in December of 2009, a heartbeat from 2010, and who basically sends a signal to the largest powers on Earth about their capabilities and what they do or do not wish us to do next.
More to talk with you about, Richard. Grab a quick call. Terry in Estancia, New Mexico. Hi, Terry. Go ahead.
Hi, George and Richard. I'm so glad to get a hold of you. I'm kind of perplexed at who to talk to about this. I don't know if Richard, his opinion on the beings that you call the Greys, if he believes in them or what they are, but my son had such an experience that I mean, it scared me for him to tell me about it because he didn't even know what the Greys were. He's 20 years old. And he said that this was probably March of 2010. He woke up fully clothed in the middle of the night, but then he started remembering what had happened to him. And the only reason he even told me about it was because I listened to Coast to Coast, and mm-hmm. I was telling him about beings called the Greys, and he said, "Okay, Mom, I'm going to tell you." And he said that he never would have even mentioned it because he didn't know what they were. But he said that he had walked out of his home, and he somehow, this is such a strange thing. I don't think I've ever even heard of anything like it, but, and I'm shaky telling you about it.
Well, go ahead. No, tell us.
He was somehow, he thought he was transported into, he didn't know if it was a ship or what it was, and that he said he was lying down on some sort of a table. He says, the only thing I can describe this room as, he said it was like a, maybe a laboratory or something like that.
Well, I'm going to give you some information here, Terry, because Richard's not the one to talk to about that. But go onto our website, Google, or just search for Bud Hopkins. He's one of them that you should get a hold of. You can send him an email through our website. What your son has experienced, we hear a lot of. You're not alone with that at all. Richard, I don't believe you deal with this, right?
Well, you know, as a rule, I don't deal with UFOs, but as this thing has matriculated and we've gone from artifacts to an ancient, you know, history system that obviously is part of our own undisclosed past, to post-World War events where you have human beings developing extraordinary technologies, I mean, I have looked carefully at the whole gray phenomenon, and remember how Stanton Friedman talks about his gray basket?
His gray basket.
Yeah, well, right. I've got the grays in the gray basket. My problem with the whole gray phenomenology is that it gives us just enough information to scare the bejesus out of a lot of people, but not enough information to reach any scientific or verifiable conclusions. In other words, everyone we deal with, we're dealing with in terms of personal experience and recollection and memory, mm-hmm. and you know, some of the memories are right there, so others have to be retrieved through hypnosis. We have no artifacts to discover. The most interesting quasi-gray story that I personally investigated back before I said, no, I'm not going to pursue this path because it's not going to be productive, was with Betty and Barney Hill. You know that I actually did managed to spend an evening back in the 60s with Betty and Barney up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and got direct from, you know, Betty her whole description of their encounter, their abduction, if you want to call it that. And the most interesting thing that came out of it for me was the star map.
Right.
And then
which
I
was
prompted,
later converted, right? The
well,
Marjorie Fish.
Alan, yeah. Hynek, my friend, to actually get some further data on the map, which he went and did. And ultimately, Margaret Fish developed a three-dimensional representation of the solar system and its environs out to, I forget how many light years, maybe a couple of dozen. And Margaret Fish was a astronomy teacher and student who was able to, from Betty's
description,
reconstruction, put together an actual 3D model of the map, and that's where the whole mythology that the grays come from Zeta Reticuli came from.
Right, right.
The problem is, if we're dealing with controlled systems for controlled cultural information release and manipulation, you can't trust any of it, George. You can't trust what the government's telling you. You can't trust what abductees are telling you, because they're, of course, have been, shall we say, manhandled by a force or forces that are totally beyond their ken, if you take their word at face value. And there's so many of these stories now that have so many correlating points that I think we can lay to rest that this is something merely in the mind or simply, you know, aberrant psychology. I think people are actually undergoing serious experiences. The question is, by whom, for what purpose, and on what time scale? And you have talked with Melinda Leslie on this show several times.
Yes.
Who is a very credible researcher who has an entire developed model that the powers that be, particularly the military, have been engaging in their own kind of quasi-abduction scenario, utilizing drugs and other technologies to make people think that aliens are abducting them when, in fact, it's just, you know, black ops. And again, it's designed to conceal by throwing up a huge screen of noise as opposed to keeping something totally secret. You cannot keep secret from a culture the fact that another culture chooses to intrude and to interface, to react with, to personally meet, come in contact with beings on Earth. But what you can do, if your political, you know, marching orders are to keep this forever in the twilight zone, do not let it become real, do not ever let it become a credible, serious discussion, you throw in a whole bunch of crazy stuff by manipulated black ops maneuvers to where the signal, if there is a signal in the reportage, is very hard to find. And then you throw into that mix that the human guys, the black ops guys, may have access to some of this physics and technology which they use to make them appear to be aliens. And there's no way your average person is going to figure it out without outside help.
No, there is no way. And, you know, and I believe it's probably possible some of that could be going on.
Well, the reason that I say some of this could be going on, and I echo that very, very firmly, is because I have a unique place to stand. Remember the old quote from Archimedes, you know, when he invented the lever? Give me a place to stand and I can move the Earth. I have got a database, NASA, ESA, Soviet Union, now Japan, China, and India, and the gestalt of all of these space programs unequivocally says the solar system is filled with exquisite ancient ruins in various states of disrepair, from almost pristine to where you couldn't even detect a trace if you walked over it with a magnetometer. And each of these various space programs of these various nations have been releasing the real data that allows us to draw that conclusion without proclaiming it officially themselves, which gets back to Brookings. You know that I found a document, an official NASA document from 1959, commissioned by NASA as soon as the, you know, the signature had been signed by Dwight Eisenhower setting up NASA. NASA turned around and set up an agency within an agency called the Division of Long-Range Planning or something like that, which in turn turned to the Brookings Institution, which is one of America's leading think tanks probably in the world. And the Brookings Institution, with the help of a whole bunch of people, some of whom I actually work with, like Margaret Mead at the American Museum of Natural History up in New York, spent a year looking at all kinds of implications if NASA were to find evidence that we were not alone. And their document, which was called unofficially the Brookings Report, which is available through Enterprise, just go to enterprise.com and scroll down to the bottom, and you'll click on, you know, the background of the Enterprise mission, and you'll come to the links there. This document, this Brookings document, is incredibly revealing because it not only says that it is most likely that the human race will not meet extraterrestrials within the next 20 years. Remember, this is written in 59.
Right.
How do they know 20 years? What made them say 20 years? Is that like part of a plan?
Well, then also Churchill said during a UFO episode that, we can't reveal this. It will destroy religions and organized government.
That was the modus vivendi circa the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Now, remember what, of course, you weren't there, but you probably have read about it somewhere. Remember what, I'm blanking on his name. General Douglas MacArthur. Remember his famous last speech at West Point?
About fading away?
No. This is the speech where he told the cadets to prepare for the next war, which was going to be an interplanetary war, George.
Yeah.
Douglas MacArthur.
MacArthur, yeah. The Dwight talked about the industrial military complex.
Yes, yes. And he left office saying, beware of the military industrial complex. Again, this is code. This is code to other people that already know the reality, that know the secret. Dwight Eisenhower was telling us about the massive control of information and money and power that comes with it by centralizing all your basks in the corporate exit, where you basically have no independent fourth estate to ask questions and to get answers. And Douglas MacArthur was warning the cadets to get ready for an interplanetary war. Now, what could MacArthur have known that would make him stand up in public? And you can Google MacArthur's speech.
Yeah, no, you're right. He did say that.
Yes. You've already out-Googled me.
I remember it from a few years ago.
Okay.
You're right.
The point is, I'm saying that tonight in 2010, disclosure is available all around you. All you have to do is look. Our best and our brightest have been trying to tell us for decades that the history of the human race is not what we think it is tonight. And it is slowly, over decades, been moving us to the point where the curve could now be vastly accelerated. And those people who are connected, like our audience listening tonight, all you have to do is use Google. Google is your friend. You will find evidence of everything we have discussed tonight in the open mainstream news. It's just not bugled that this is the big D. It's designed to prepare people without scaring the bejesus out of them. That's my take.
Richard, when we come back, I want to find out why you're so excited about Mercury on the moon, and then we'll take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, to get the rest of your week going, our next Coast to Coast program features Dr. Sam Parnia joining me. What happens when we die? His new research on afterlife, after death experiences. So get ready for that. When we come back with Richard C., more about space and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Bill is in West Hartford, Connecticut. Go ahead, Bill. You're on the air with Richard C. Hoagland.
Yes. Hi, Richard. Hi. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Richard. I have a great question to you about Data's head, the android head located at Shorty Crater of Apollo 17. But I first want to say to you briefly that I used to hear you way back in the late 1980s to 1990 on a Saturday night with Jim Bohannon on the Jim Bohannon Show. Oh. And I even spoke to you in 1990 when I was age 40, unfortunately living at my parents' house then, and you cheered me up by saying Buckminster Fuller didn't become famous till after age 40.
He almost tried to commit suicide because he thought his life was over, and then it totally blossomed out when he followed his heart.
Wow. Well, let me get to my question. Richard, do you think there's any remote chance that with the photo that the photo or photos that was taken of Data's head, considering there's a big red stripe on the neck part of the object that either Gene Cernan or more importantly Jack Schmidt, the scientist, would have somehow gotten that object into the sample container bags, one of them, and secretly brought them back to Earth, and that has been dissected over the last 40 years.
You know, that is my exquisitely overarching question myself. Did they notice it? Did they rappel themselves down the slope? Did they have a rope on the rover in stores? Could they have actually done? They couldn't have done it by themselves. They would have had to have taken a rope. But remember, under 1/6G, if they anchored the rope on, you know, by tying it to the lunar rover, they could easily have backed their way down that slope and picked that thing up and brought it back with them, which would have been the reason for the entire Apollo program. I mean, I now believe that Apollo was commissioned by Kennedy to secretly go to the moon to find artifacts, to find the proof of the disclosure evidence that we talk about on this show, and he was going to make it public, and that's why they killed him. And the reason I think that, well, there are a couple of reasons. One is kind of out in the normal historical literature, which is Sergei Khrushchev, Premier Khrushchev's son, has said many times now on the record that sometime in middle November of 1963, after years and years and years of Kennedy being after Khrushchev to say yes, and Khrushchev saying no, 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 or yet, 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 about 12 days before Kennedy was killed, Khrushchev is walking with his son in the garden of the dock outside Moscow, and he says to Sergei, he says, I'm going to accept the president's offer. We're going to go to the moon with the Americans together. It'll save so much money, and, you know, what we find there we will share with all mankind. Well, 12 days later, they killed Kennedy, and shortly after that, they put Khrushchev under house arrest, and he died a broken man under imprisonment by the Soviet system because the Cold War obviously could not be allowed to end on that note, and what is out there on the moon could not be shared by everyone as Kennedy had tried to envision. Now, why did Kennedy think there was something there? This has been a major question that I have tried to answer, and I have put out some DVDs, and if you want to know the backstory, you simply go to enterprisemission.com and follow the links. But the most interesting new piece of information that I have that tells me that Data's head is part of a stunning technological treasure trove just waiting there for any nation or private group that gets the resources together to go to the moon and scoop it up and bring it or something like it back, is because we had an amazing breakthrough happen this past fall in 2010, George, the year we made contact. I remember I agreed to go and speak at Stephen Greer's conference in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I did that is I thought I might be able to smoke something interesting from the inside out in a kind of an inverse of the conversation that Stephen is having with insiders. I thought if someone wanted to show me something, tell me something, whatever, that it might be a useful place to be if someone wanted to share something with Enterprise. Well, no sooner had I gotten off stage than a guy comes up to me and he gives me a name that I really think was a pseudonym, and the reason is he told me that he knew of the whereabouts of some very secret NASA film that he wanted to personally give to me, that had come into his possession, that had never been seen in public, that would confirm the artifacts model of the moon, and he had access to it, and he wanted me to have it. Well, long story short, I sent a representative to a undisclosed location. This representative then picks up his cell phone, calls me literally
That means you sent Robin out.
No, I did not. Right. No, it was not Robin. No. This is someone that would have, I mean, her background is in the medical area, so I needed someone who understood NASA and film and that kind of thing, so I sent someone else.
Okay.
Anyway, this person calls me and said, you're never going to believe what I'm looking at here in the parking lot. I mean, cell phones make it possible to do transactions everywhere, right?
Sure, that's right.
He said, this is not NASA film. This is, in fact, a secret mission to test the first spy satellite, and he gave me the number series, and I won't get into all that tonight, but he authenticated the film in terms of its background history and the mission and when it was launched, which was July 29th, 1966, as part of the continuing development from Eisenhower through Kennedy into Johnson of secret reconnaissance spy satellite imagery of Russian missile bases in the former Soviet Union. Okay? We were terrified that they would launch a first strike and we could not defend ourselves, et cetera, et cetera. So Eisenhower had proposed something called open skies, which Khrushchev had rejected. And then they went through the CIA to satellite technology, and they developed under what was called Project Corona. I'll get back to that in a moment. A very important series of technologies that would allow us to look down on any part of the Soviet Union and basically tell you know, the CIA what the guys on the ground were having for lunch or breakfast. Well, this film, which was part of this huge effort to figure out how the Soviet Union might attack us, when my guy is describing the film in the parking lot, he says, "You're not going to believe this, but every single frame." Remember, George, shot by a reconnaissance spy satellite in Earth orbit, was not of the Soviet Union, was not of airfields and missile bases and submarine pens, et cetera, et cetera. They were all taken of the moon. Every single frame from Earth orbit across 250,000 miles with a kind of film technology and a telescopic technology that wouldn't see the light of day in the unexpurgated literature, the non-classified literature, for a generation. Now, you know how fragile space missions can be, right? They can die at a moment's notice.
You got that right.
Or even without a notice. So if you're testing a system whose purpose is to look down on the Soviet Union and to track missiles and submarines and launch capability and, you know, military hardware and the production facilities and all that, why are you wasting this precious orbit time and parachuting film back from space to be picked up by an aircraft and then flown to CIA headquarters where it is developed and analyzed within hours of being picked up? Why are you shooting your entire rolls of film of the moon and not of the Soviet Union?
They know something.
They not only knew something, but I believe the precursors to this mission gave Kennedy enough information to launch Apollo, whose secret mission was to go and retrieve artifacts and bring them back for analysis, including something like Data's head. And the entire mystique, the entire canard, the entire fairy story of the Cold War and us being terrified of the Soviet Union's missile forces and deployments is proven to be a lie by this first new mission, which had as its prime objective photographing the moon in stunning close-up from Earth orbit and having nothing to do with the threat, which is ostensibly 100 miles underneath its orbit.
Were these artifacts, could they possibly have been from our planet? Maybe we went there a million years ago?
Well, now you get into the really exciting soap opera, which is who did what to whom and when did they do it?
Yeah.
I think, frankly, that Cremo is right, Thompson is right, Graham is right, Robert Bavall is right, the bunch of us that are looking, you know, like Joseph Farrell is right, that we know nothing, George, of our real history. I mean nothing. We've been kept like a hothouse plant in the dark, fed a nice diet of you-know-what to keep us fat and happy. And every time someone raises the curtain or lifts up the edge of the tent to try to find the real history and who's out there, they are either cut down, they're either marginalized, made to appear to be something they're not, like the Assange story, or they're killed outright, like Kennedy. The bottom line is that this cruise that Robin and I are going to be on with Jim Mars and a bunch of other really exciting people, including Mike Barra is going to be there, you know, talking about his almost transformation from a physics guy and an engineering guy into a consciousness guy, because this physics, which is pervading all our background now, is changing consciousness even as we speak. There's actual corroborating data, numerical data, like the Flynn curve that we can point to.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm doing the cruise is to bring all this together on a ship as a floating metaphor for the spaceship we're all on, and I'm going to show people things that they've only heard about. I've been saving a lot of good stuff for the right frame, the right venue, the right big as the subject matter itself occasion to bring it out in a coherent form. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about for those 7 days, up to and including star parties at night on the upper deck so you can get familiar with the real sky. And leaving the cruise, I need to give out 1-800 numbers so people who do not have computers can get to it. If you have a computer, simply Google cruiseinto2012.com, and it will take you right there. If you don't have a computer, there's an 800 number to call, which is 866-348-4638. That's 866-348-4638. And I'm going to show proof, and we're leading up to this last little tidbit about the moon, that in fact disclosure has occurred. You just have to know what to look for.
All right, let's go to Winchester, Virginia. Mike, it's your turn. We'll get you in here. Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Do either of you know why the TV networks don't want us to have space TV shows?
What do you mean space TV shows?
Like the TV show Space Above and Beyond, it was on Sunday nights, and we only got 1 year of it, and nothing like that since.
Would you say ratings, Richard? What do you think?
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of competition now for getting people, you know, making a buck out of getting people ready. I mean, look at the number of major feature films having to do with space, extraterrestrials, ET invasions, who's out there. I think there's something like a dozen or two dozen major films coming at us over the next 3 or 4 months. So I'm not sure about this particular show. I know there's a whole bunch of space shows and ever more popping up. The question, of course, is what's the agenda?
What is the agenda? David in Crawford, Colorado, it's your turn. Hey, David, go ahead.
Hi, George. I know we're running out of time here, but I got a serious question to ask Mr. Hoagland for a long
sure.
time.
Okay.
We as a our orbiting planets moving into the level of the galaxy. Are we moving into that level at 90 degrees? I got two questions. Depends on how you answer the first one. Are we moving into the center of the galaxy at 90 degrees, or are we being propelled into the spiral?
Okay. First of all, this idea that we're moving anywhere near the center of the galaxy is total nonsense.
Okay.
The center of the galaxy is about 26,000 light years from the solar system,
right,
in the direction of Sagittarius.
Okay.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it takes us about a quarter of a billion, that's a B, a quarter of a billion years for the solar system at our distance from the center of the galaxy to orbit once. When people talk loosely about moving into the center, what they're talking about is an alignment, an optical alignment that the Mayans noticed and others have noticed, that occurs again around, you know, 2012. It's not an exact time. It's a window of time stretching from 1998 forward by about 20 or 30 years. As the alignment of the winter solstice in the northern hemisphere of the Earth looking across the sun toward the center of the galaxy, there is an alignment within a few degrees. Now, a number of people like John Major Jenkins and others have made a big deal about this, and I
right.
think they're onto something, because what we have found is that if you add other unseen components to that alignment between the sun, the galactic center, and the Earth in this 2012 window, it's not a date, it's a window, you can get some unusual physics torsion field effects, and we're looking for what those effects are, how they can be measured, if they're triggered by unseen planets orbiting far away from the sun that have not been formally found by astronomers yet. And so I'm looking at the 2012 window as a time when something triggers the physics, which will do interesting things. And the question is, how interesting is interesting? And I want it to stay on the safe side of interesting and not on the catastrophic side. And tonight I have no idea what exactly is going to take place. I'm just gathering data that something could take place. And on the cruise, I intend to lay out what our data is so far, that there's a physics to back this up.
I am predicting some kind of an event from the sun, Richard.
The sun could be a part of it because the sun fields and cycles are triggered by planetary motions. We know that now, that the 22-year sunspot cycle is a conglomeration of the orbital periods of Jupiter and Saturn, and they basically wag the torsion field dog because of their angular momentum. So you're probably right. The sun is somehow in the mix, but I think there's a lot more than just the sun.
Absolutely. Richard, thanks again for being on the program. Richard C. Hoagland, our special guest. A couple of his books, by the way, Monuments of Mars, of course, and his bestseller, Dark Mission, his website, enterprisemission.com. He's also our scientific advisor and sends us regular stories and updates on scientific stories that seems to be breaking all the time. 2011, it's underway for Jason Bowers, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.